When your company earns unlimited 2% cash back on all purchases with Capital One, that's serious business. So, Steven at SandCloud got a serious business card, the Spark Cash Plus card from Capital One.
We used our 2% cash back to help build our retail presence.
Savvy, Steven.
And we get big purchasing power, so our business can spend more and earn more.
The Spark Cash Plus card from Capital One. What's in your wallet?
Terms and conditions apply. Find out more at CapitalOne.com/SparkCashPlus.
In Indiana, summer means more than sunshine. It's hiking miles and miles of trails to magnificent views and cruising through caves on underground river rides. It's spending the night in a floating cabin and scuba diving into your next big adventure. It's riding a horse and buggy through historic towns and camping with elephants at a wildlife park. It's anything but ordinary. Plan your trip at inindiana.com/summer.
Hello and welcome back to ACRAC. I'm Jed Wolpaw, and we have a fabulous show for you today. I have with me Dr. Alyssa Walsh, who is at Massachusetts General Hospital, where she did her training. She was a resident there, and then she stayed on and became a chief resident, no small feat. And then she did an ICU fellowship, and now she's an instructor at Harvard Medical School at MGH. She's also the director of SICU resident education there. So she's really interested in how we train our trainees and how we teach in general. And what an interesting way to apply that. She's taken an interest in central lines, and that's what we're going to talk about today. So we'll talk a little bit about how she got interested in it. We'll talk about the different ways to place them, where they can be placed, what can go wrong, how we can make sure that we are picking the place we should, what we know about how to train people in this, and then, of course, what we can do to confirm if the line is where we want it to be. So I think this is going to be a great conversation, and I'm thrilled to have her on the show. Alyssa, welcome to ACRAC.
Thank you so much, Jed. It's truly an honor to be here. I remember listening to this podcast ever since I was a CA1. I took some really intense notes on the OR setup episode.
Awesome. I'm so glad it's been helpful. And now you will contribute to future CA1s taking notes on how to place central lines. So this will be great. Let's start by just, you know, everyone places central lines as an anesthesia trainee and anesthesiologist. But how did you get specifically interested in this as something you wanted to take a little further and get involved in the teaching of?
Yeah, so this my interest in this topic started when I was a resident. The case that really prompted my interest was I had an inadvertent azygous vein cannulation when we placed a triple lumen catheter into an existing MAC introducer. The distal end of the trich essentially eroded the azygous vein, which clinically initially manifested as medications not having their expected effect and later manifested as a worsening pleural effusion, which was essentially the medications coming from the trich into the thoracic cavity. The only real sign of trouble in the moment was that the distal port wasn't drawing back, although the other ports were fine, the other arm of the MAC was fine. So we ended up giving a combined grand rounds along with several of our attendings in cardiac and vascular anesthesia on that specific case, as well as a general approach to understanding mechanical central line complications and how we might be able to prevent them. I would say as I've transitioned to the role of as a supervisor and first as a fellow and now as staff, this topic has only interested me more.
Yeah, it really is. You know, I think on first blush, people may think, oh, yeah, central line's like, okay, it's a big IV. But I mean, it's a much more complex topic in so many ways. And we're going to cover a lot of that. And I think that's fabulous. So say a little bit about the different sites, right? We think about placing central lines, and at least I think, but you can tell me if there are more of three major locations. But what are those and how do we think about the different sites?
Excellent. So I agree. I think of three major locations as well. Two sites to sort of percutaneously access the SVC, which are the internal jugular vein or IJ and the subclavian vein, and one site to access the IVC, which is the femoral vein. In the OR environment, the vast majority of central lines that we're placing are typically in the internal jugular vein, right greater than left, with usually rare opportunities for subclavian or femoral access. In the ICU, I find that patients tend to have more mechanical or acquired barriers to central access, as well as potentially a direct contraindication to IJ access, such as a C-collar. And so there may be more exposure to use of different sites. Thinking about the three different sites, I'll talk a little bit about this more later from the three-site study. But I think things that people tend to think about for the IJ, it's very easy to ultrasound. It has a compressible arterial site. Again, it's something we're very familiar with. but there is an increased infectious and thrombotic risk. There is a risk of carotid artery puncture, and there can theoretically be a risk of airway compromise with hematoma. For the subclavian vein, it has reduced infectious and thrombotic events, and it does allow for better patient mobility, but it definitely has a higher rate of mechanical complications, most notably pneumothorax. It's more challenging to ultrasound, and it is not easily compressible. And finally, for the femoral vein, really good anatomical landmarks, really easy to ultrasound, again, has a compressible arterial site, but definitely has an increased infectious thrombotic risk and limits patient mobility. And in the event of a retroperitoneal hematoma, that can obviously be life-threatening.
Yeah, great. Absolutely. And, you know, I think you mentioned, and I know we'll get to this, but, you know, it used to be that, well, certainly even before my time, it used to be there was no ultrasound, right? So it was just all of these were done blind. And then when I was learning, IJs were just kind of getting to the point where they were almost always done with ultrasound, but subclavians were never done with ultrasound, and femorals kind of half and half. And now I feel like we're at a point where it's almost always ultrasound for any of these. You still I think it's still acceptable to do a subclavian blind, but I think a lot of people are starting to go to the ultrasound approach if they can. Do you agree with that?
I definitely agree with that. The best data for use of dynamic ultrasound for prevention of mechanical complications is in the IJ, but increasingly there's been more data available for subclavian and femoral sites too. And the most recent systematic reviews and meta-analyses have also supported the use of ultrasound for those sites.
Great. All right. So let's talk about those mechanical complications. What can go wrong? What do we know about it? What should we be thinking about?
So the main complications that are described in the literature, the first one is inadvertent arterial puncture or cannulation. That would be the carotid artery, the subclavian artery, or the femoral artery. Second one is direct venous injury. That includes things such as back walling, but can really go to anything beyond, including, you know, kind of catastrophic venous injuries leading to involvement in vascular surgery. Third major bucket I think of is malpositioning, which you can further break down into intra or extravascular malpositioning. For intravascular malpositioning, this means your line's in a vein, but it's not the right vein. It's not sitting at the SVCRA junction. So classically, that's the azygos vein, the internal thoracic veins, the superior intercostal veins, or the axillary veins. And then for extravascular malpositioning, I would summarize the case report literature as if you can dream it, it can be done. There was one that I found that was a really fantastic but unfortunate image of a triple lumen that was in the esophagus during an EGD. Most of these very extreme malpositions were done without ultrasound, but no, it does exist in the literature. Other complications that are described, pneumothorax or hemothorax, and pericardial effusion, usually due to a puncture of the lower SVC, the right atrium, or the right ventricle, guide wire retention, and chylothorax.
Yeah, none of which are fun when they happen to you. So we want to try to avoid all of these things. Do you want to talk about kind of best practices for trying to avoid these things happening? You know, kind of how common are they? And is there anything that we can do to, if we have to place a central line, to try to avoid them?
Great question. So a lot of the data on the incidence of these mechanical complications is predating the use of ultrasound. Which makes it a little bit challenging, but I'll describe some of the more recent studies in terms of the exact incidence. There was a Keystone Review article in the NEJM in about 2003. It was published by McGee et al. They estimated, just looking at the available data at the time, it was estimated that there was a 6 to 20% risk of central line complications based on the available data, which is almost one in five central lines. Specifically, the things they reported on were arterial puncture, hematoma, hemothorax, and pneumothorax. There was also another piece of data around the same time. There was a closed claims report released from the ASA looking at the past 30 years central line complications that were reported for malpractice. The most common they saw was wire catheter embolus or retention, cardiac tamponade, carotid artery puncture, cannulation, hemothorax, or pneumothorax. And from that paper, they had recommended routine either static or dynamic ultrasound use of manometry, and routinely reviewing the post-procedural chest x-ray. A little bit more recent data, the three-site study in 2015 was a French multi-center randomized controlled trial. It randomly assigned patients to receive either an IJ femoral or subclavian line in a 1-to-1-to-1 ratio, or if only two sites were suitable in a 1-to-1 ratio. They could only have one site suitable. They were excluded from the study. They ended up looking at 3,500 catheters and about 3,000 patients. So some patients had multiple catheters. These were all placed by experienced providers, which were defined as people who had done greater than 50 placements. Ultrasound notably was optional in this study, despite it being 2015. But when they looked at the data there, they saw that in general, subclavian lines, much decreased risk of infectious thrombotic risk, but much higher mechanical complications. They noted 18 events in total from that study, 13 of which were pneumothorax compared to the IJ and femoral sites. And then finally, most recently, there was a BGA prospective multicenter cohort study from 2022, looking at 13,000 catheter insertions in 2019 to 2020. And they were looking at the rate of mechanical complications, both major and minor, with the use of ultrasound. And they actually still found that we had a 7.7% rate of mechanical complications, only 0.4% major, but still higher than I would have expected. They then looked at the risk factors for those complications. Some of them were really no surprise to me: more skin and vessel punctures, large bore central lines, limited experience, which they defined as operators who had placed fewer than 100 central lines. Some more interesting ones were lower BMI patients, particularly for major complications, which I think is related that there's more risk of extravascular placement damage to surrounding structures. And then a very funny one was that male operator gender was significantly associated with major mechanical complications. It was actually the highest risk factor with an odds ratio of 3.3.
Really?
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Did they hypothesize why that might be?
You know, they did in the discussion section. I forget the exact way that they phrased it, but it was something to the line of like, the amount of force that was used.
Interesting. I thought they were going to say just kind of the right way to describe it would be. But in general, I would think that men are more likely to keep plowing ahead despite despite signs that perhaps they're not going the right way. Right. This is much like many men who are not willing to ask for directions. Right. So correct. I think that Well, certainly this is not applicable to everybody, right? We can't always categorize by gender, but I think that that's certainly the stereotype, if nothing else, and it might apply here too, right? Is that you kind of have this feeling like, okay, I've got to get this. And actually where this fits is if you think about kind of the imposter syndrome so many people have, and again, this has nothing to do with being a man or a woman, but you can imagine that for anyone, you're placing a line, especially if you're a trainee and you kind of feel like you're supposed to be able to do it. And if you're having trouble, you may be reluctant to say, hey, I'm not sure this is right, or I'm having trouble, and to just keep plowing along and kind of hoping for the best. And that is something we all need to address, right? We, as I think as faculty, need to make sure we make it clear that it's okay to say, I'm not, you know, can you help me out? Right. I'm not sure this is going well. That might prevent some of this. Who knows? But that's something that we should all be thinking about.
I absolutely agree. And the literature would also support that. There is only a little bit of data available on sort of the number of attempts that one operator should make before you switch off. But from that same Keystone article from the NEJM in 2003, they said the rate of mechanical complications increases 6x when there's at least 3 attempts by the same operator. There's another group that estimated a risk of mechanical complications that was 10x with a second attempt and 40 times as likely with greater than 2 attempts with an experienced operator. All in all to say, I totally agree. We should really be supporting our trainees there and helping to step in.
Yeah, 100%. And, you know, it's, of course, I mean, there's no way to know this for sure, but it seems to me like part of the problem is that if you are in the midst of trying and you're, you know, what I think happens a lot from just, this is not based on data, this is just my own, you know, 10 years of training, of teaching people to do it, is that people don't know where the tip of their needle is. And so you're kind of fishing around. You think you're seeing your tip, but you're actually looking at the shaft. And so the tip is somewhere distal. It could be in another vessel. It could be in the lung. And you know, I think the advantage of stopping and letting someone else try is the needle comes out completely, right? And then someone else
completely
tries. Yeah. And I think that's a big difference, because often when we quote unquote try again, we kind of just do the same thing, but maybe like a little left or a little right. But, you know, we're not really rethinking the whole approach. And that's my guess as to why it gets a lot worse with the same person trying again, because you're just kind of you're not rethinking the whole process. You're just making slight changes that aren't correcting the underlying problem.
Exactly. And I think, too, you know, as another operator steps in, they may do things to like do little micro adjustments on positioning, provide more sedation if it's an awake patient to help them better tolerate it. There are a lot of things you can do. I think there's a lot of benefit to just taking a breather, reevaluating where we're at, and then making a second attempt after we've already decided what we can do differently for a new approach. Absolutely. Whether it's a different person, more tools, repositioning the patient, giving more sedation, something to help make the next attempt different from the first.
Yeah. So let's talk about how we should be training people, right? I mean, the traditional approach was see one, do one, teach one. So, you know, that mm-hmm. is probably not the best way, but how should we be teaching people to do this well and safely to try to minimize complications?
So yeah, the old Halsted mantra, see one, do one, teach one. In general, I think, you know, the education literature is leaning away from that for multiple reasons. Number one, it's not providing consistent experience. Number two, it's not providing consistent feedback, and related to that may perpetuate bad habits. There was actually a really interesting study that was looking at the adherence of quote unquote expert attendings for a central line placement simulated environment, sort of one of the standard checklists for safety. And actually only about 20% of those expert attendings met or exceeded the minimum passing score for IJ placements on the checklist, which I think is again getting at essentially get perpetuation of bad habits, even if you've clinically been doing these lines very frequently. So thinking about like how we can train people and how we can do it better. I think the best experience that we can provide is likely some combination of a review of the basics. So anatomy of the venous system, principles of ultrasound, including how the ultrasound works, finding your needle, keeping it in plane, sterile technique, different devices that we might place, things of that nature, with some sort of repeated simulation exposure and supervision and feedback on some sort of objective competency metrics, like one of the checklists, number of needle passes, that sort of thing. That's where I think things are headed in the future.
Yeah, I think that makes a lot of sense, trying to have some sort of standardized approach with a way of evaluating how the training is going, right? Rather than, you know, have you seen one? Okay, now you're ready to do one. But, and as you said,
I actually remember when I was an intern, so I did my intern year in internal medicine, and they were like, if you've seen or done 5 central lines, you're certified to go supervise them yourself. And I now think that is totally crazy.
Right, right. Yeah, I mean, and as we said before, right, you could have 5 skinny people with large IJ veins that, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. are just like you could drop a needle from a height and it would land in the IJ, right? As opposed to someone with a, you know, relatively small IJ, maybe a partially mm-hmm. occluded IJ who's got a lot of soft tissue in the way, who's got maybe a, you know, a reason they can't be in full Trendelenburg. I mean, you know, lots of things that would make that a very much more difficult line to play. So having some sort of metric that you know how to do this, you know how to troubleshoot. So what about, you know, sim, obviously, observation in sim, like you said, counting, you know, certain adheres to certain checklists, all that makes sense. There's very new, I think, data on using things like hand motion tracking of the hand, vision tracking of where someone's eyes are going to predict expertise. Is there any use of that you know of in training for central line placement?
Yeah, so there's a group at Pennsylvania State University that has been actually doing a lot of work on this topic. So they developed this dynamic haptic robot trainer, which essentially the robot arm helps to provide force feedback and the system generates a synthetic ultrasound image. So it can actually sense the movement of the needle as well as the pressure from the user. It can also simulate like an easy versus a medium versus a challenging patient with different programs. And it can give immediate feedback to the residents in terms of, well, how many needle passes did you make? What was the angle of entry? How much pressor did you use? Were you aspirating the entire time? So I think that's really, really exciting stuff. As far as I could tell, only from their group right now, They had a couple studies published on it, one looking at sort of the comparison of the robot trainer with mannequins, and found that it was at least equivocal in helping to prepare residents for central line placement. They had another study where they also incorporated the use of visual tracking, so seeing sort of gaze, like using the same simulated trainer. Where was the gaze preference for experienced attendings, senior residents, and interns during a central line cannulation with this trainer? And they found that for novices, they tended to spend significantly less time than experts and senior residents on the ultrasound screen, and more time looking at their needle and ultrasound probe, which I think I've witnessed before, sort of like anecdotally as well. But it was cool to see that they could kind of more quantitatively record that and give that feedback to their trainees.
Yeah, that's very cool. And, you know, I think this is where we're eventually going, and it's going to take a little while. But I've seen interesting studies in like radiology where they can tell the difference, you know, blinded between an expert attending and a new intern, for example, based on where their eyes go on the image, right? I saw one in nursing where they were able to tell an expert versus a novice nurse based on where their eyes were going when they were pulling meds out of the Pyxis and verifying, you know, that it was the right med. So these objective measures, I think, are going to be used much more frequently as we go. I mean, maybe at some point we'll all be wearing something on our heads that will just measure all this stuff in everything we do. But, you know, I do think this will become more and more central in education going forward.
Yeah, I was really, really intrigued by this program, and it's something I wish we had, because currently right now, I don't know how you guys have for your institution, but we have mannequins mostly for our central line training. Our mannequins only provide sort of the experience of one patient type. They also tend to be a little bit beaten up after multiple trainers have practiced on them. So they help, and definitely it can help with some of the familiarity with how to position your ultrasound, stabilize your ultrasound, pass your needle. But I don't think it gives that same experience or experience over multiple different patient types. It also requires that you have a dedicated second person who's directly observing you and giving feedback. Whereas I like kind of that this can give you that more quantitative feedback up front.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, very cool. I'm excited to see where we go with kind of teaching in these things in the future. Stay with us. We'll be right back. All right, and we're back. So let's talk about how to confirm that your central line's in the right place. For as long as I've been aware, there was one and only one way to do this, which was you put your central line in and you get a chest x-ray, which I think is still an acceptable option, but there are others. So tell us about that. What do we know about different options for this and maybe what we should be doing?
Yeah, so starting with the oldest, there's definitely the chest x-ray. There's surprisingly conflicting literature on exactly where the line tip should be to represent the SVCRA junction. One that I found that seemed about right to me was within two vertebral spaces of the carina. That should correspond to a level above the pericardial reflection, thus minimizing the risk of tamponade, but kind of close enough to the right atrium that things like central venous pressure monitoring, medication delivery should be adequate. I would say for chest x-ray, it can definitely exclude some immediate complications such as pneumothorax, pleural effusion, but it is more challenging to confirm a malposition directly, particularly if it's a more subtle malposition such as in the azygous vein. Manometry is probably the simplest intra-procedural modality, which is mainly just trying to exclude either an arterial puncture or an extravascular placement. Ultrasound by far and away is the most popular at our institution, and I would say is now standard of care. It's funny looking back at the literature because there was definitely resistance to ultrasound adaptation for a while, sort of with the basis of, well, people should know how to place a slide the landmark. This is an option if it's challenging, but people do their landmarks. Now I would say the data is pretty definitive that, particularly for the IJ again, dynamic ultrasound is reducing the time to cannulation, reducing the time for the number of attempts. It's improving the rate of success, like both first pass and overall, and it's reducing the rate of mechanical complications overall. And as I said, while the initial data on subclavian femoral is a little bit more mixed, I think that that's likely to be standard of care for those sites as well. Some other level ups that I think of. So the bicable view on TE is a particularly powerful way to directly visualize the wire at the SVCRA junction. And I would say that's the standard of care in our cardiac suites. But it's another good thing to consider if you have another challenging line in the OR or in the ICU with an anesthetized patient. The TT as well, there are some views in which you can get a sense of the wire setting at the SVCRA junction. You can do a right supraclavicular fossa view, which can sort of get the upper part of the SVC. And if you can really, really crank and look down, you might be able to see the RA starting. You can also do an apical or subcostal four-chamber view to get a view of the SVCRA junction. Some of the ways that we've done that in the ICU for our institution are we have a second provider who comes in with the TTE and looks under the drapes. You can also use agitated saline. Once you have the line placed, you could do like or some sort of catheter. You could use agitated saline and see if you see that on the right side of the heart on TTE. And then finally, fluoroscopy is something that's often used in our vascular suite. We also use it for some placement of some of our particularly large bore lines, such as for BV bypass lines during liver transplants. That can help to identify the site of the wire, identify any obstructions, and delineate the surrounding anatomy all in real time. So it's another really powerful level up technique, particularly in the operating room environment. So ultimately, I think, like, as you're thinking about your central lines, both in the OR and ICU, definitely some combination of dynamic ultrasound. Manometry is probably also a nice thing for safety, followed by a chest x-ray after. But for challenging lines, I'd really consider incorporating one of those advanced modalities to confirm your wire and then catheter at the SVCRA junction. So that's, again, TE, TTE, or fluoroscopy.
Yeah, thanks. That's a really nice overview. And, you know, I think that there's kind of the two aspects of this, right? One is, as you're placing it, before you dilate, you want to ideally know you're in at least a vein and not the artery. I mean, that's always nice to know, right? Before you dilate up the carotid artery, especially if you're placing something large, like a dialysis catheter. And so for that, as you said, certainly ultrasound is nice. And I think, at least I don't know, but as far as I know, everywhere I've ever been, for IJs at least, ultrasound is now standard of care. And, you know, ultrasound for seeing where you are, I guess that it, in what I think of it as where I'm looking as I'm placing an IJ, it isn't probably a guarantee because it's once you get that wire in, you can't see the distal end of it. Now, you talked about some methodologies for using ultrasound to see the distal end of the wire. But just where you're seeing it, you can see that at some point, some part of your wire is at least has gone through the IJ. But whether it ended there or not, that isn't, I think, definitive for that. Certainly, I think manometry is, I really like to do that. I think that knowing that you're in a vein is quite reassuring before you dilate. And then once the line is in is kind of the secondary thing that we I think always do to want to know where is this thing? Is it correctly positioned? Even if we did manometry and we know for a fact that it's not in an artery, as you said several times during our discussion here, that doesn't mean that it is definitely at the correct area that you want it to be at. So a chest x-ray is the traditional way to do this. I have actually heard that some folks, and I don't know if you're doing this routinely, but have actually gotten away from chest x-rays completely, and they're using TTE to as their confirmatory test to figure out if this is in the right place. Are you doing that at all? Are you still doing chest x-rays when you place, let's say, in the ICU, when you place a central line?
We're still very traditional here. We still do chest x-rays for every post-procedural central line, but I've definitely seen literature suggesting that with, you know, point of care ultrasound, you can visualize the positioning of the catheter. You can rule out pneumothorax, pneumothorax, pleural effusions like that. That could probably replace the chest x-ray in a lot of cases. And I didn't mention this, but just to say, like, if you have significant concern about an extravascular catheter, getting a CT scan will help you best sort of delineate which of the surrounding structures it's ended up in.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, it was interesting. You know, when I first heard somebody talking about this, I thought, well, because they said one of the ways they do it is they inject agitated saline while looking at the right heart. And I thought, well, that'll tell you if you're in a vein. But I don't know if it tells you you're at the right place. But they actually said that if you are good at this, you know, obviously if you're sitting at the, you know, SVC right atrial junction, like you're going to see those bubbles instantly. If you're in the azygos or out in the, you know, brachial, you're going to, it's going to take a little longer.
It's going to be more delayed. Totally. Yeah.
Exactly. So I think you can figure out if you're in the right place if you're good at this, which is something I think we'll probably see more of as people get more facile with TTE.
I think so too. And it's something that I've been trying to practice more as well, like particularly in the ICU.
Yeah. Yeah. So what about, you know, it is amazing when you talk to some older faculty, they'll tell you that it used to be, not only did everybody get a central line, but central lines in the ICU got changed every 3 days, right? So, I mean, people did so many central lines. Every, you know, any even moderately big case in the OR got a central line, in the ICU, everybody got a central line, and then those central lines were replaced every 3 days. And then, you know, it's gotten, there's no question that over the time since I started medical school, the past 15 years, we have seen a real decrease in the number of overall central lines placed. I think most people would probably think that's a good thing, as where there are definitely complications, as we've talked about, associated with central lines, not only in the placement of, but in the, you know, in the longer term in terms of infection risk. But I wonder if you think we are at a point where we're now, are we good? Should we be placing even fewer, or are we placing too few? I certainly know that I've had times in the OR where we may spend, you know, 45 minutes, even with the ultrasound, trying to, a patient who has these tiny little arm veins, and we're just desperately trying to get a decent size IV in. And in the end, everything blows, and then we end up doing a central line, or maybe we settle for lines that we really didn't think were good enough. And then sure enough, in the middle of the case, we're scrambling to put a central line in. So I wonder if we've swung too far and we really should have a better idea of when it's, because I think right now the default is basically like, never place a central line unless you absolutely have to. And is, you know, I don't know, you may not know the answer to this, but I'm just wondering, is that right? Or have we swung too far?
Yeah. Yeah. I totally agree. Like, I think it's definitely without question that we're placing fewer than we did before. I think a lot of that is due to fear of mechanical complications, as well as fear of like catheter related infections, which I didn't talk about, but obviously that's something that's a really important metric that a lot of ORs and ICU look at. So overall, and there's also, you know, there's been trends away from things like hemodynamic monitoring of central venous pressure. There's been trends for less invasive surgeries. There's been greater acceptance of use of peripheral vasopressors through IVs. So I think all of those things have kind of reduced the use of central lines overall. And then looking at how many, you know, I was trying to look for data of how many central lines we're placing for patients who do need them. And in the U.S., there was one study that was published in ANA in, I think, 2017. They actually saw that there was a 40% decrease in billing claims for non-tunnel trench lines placed by anesthesiologists. With a redistribution, it looked like to PAs or advanced practice nurses, which is probably due to the fact that dynamic ultrasound is more widely available. We have checklists for safety, and so that often results in a redistribution of different role groups, too. I'll also say there's also more availability of the PICC team for peripherally inserted central catheters as well. So yeah, I think we're definitely placing fewer. And to your question of like, is it enough? I think that, you know, while probably placing fewer central lines overall reduces the risks associated with central lines, I think it also makes it more risky if we aren't placing them frequently when we do have a line that comes in, particularly the really emergent lines that might come to us in the middle of the night. And so there has to be a way to maintain your skills as well. I kind of suspect that anesthesia residents will be well off for a while, because at least for the immediate future, I think cardiac and vascular surgery are still going to need a lot of central lines. Those procedures, similar with the ICU. But, you know, I think looking forward, as people complete their training, move on to their role as staff, I think that there has to be some sort of focus on maintenance of skills and some sort of check-in. And I think, again, like thinking back to the role of simulation and feedback, I think that that also applies to people continuing in their careers and trying to maintain these skills and maintain safety.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's all exactly right. We have to make sure people can, never say never, but I don't think we're anywhere near not ever placing central lines. And so, as you say, people need to know how to do it. I mean, we've already seen, I think most residents don't know how to place a PA catheter, so because they just don't do it anymore.
Exactly.
And I think it would be a problem if central lines went that way. So I think we do need to make sure our residents are continuing to learn how to do them, because there are going to be places where they're really necessary. And my personal feeling on this is that we have swung a little too far, where we're so afraid of central line associated bloodstream infections that we don't put central lines in in situations where the patient would be better off with a central line. So I think we need to be careful and thoughtful. And it's a good push to make sure we don't place unnecessary central lines and we get them out when we don't need them. But I think it's also important to think about getting them in when they are going to help the patient when we really think we may need them. So, you know, certain cases, as you say, cardiac, major vascular, I think PHEO, you know, active PHEOs, cases that are going to have you're going to have massive blood loss and, you can't get, huge, large bore, secure peripherals in, those are, I think, no brainers. But there are probably other cases where, you think you end up settling for a 20 in the hand when really that's not going to cut it. To each their own, certainly not telling everyone out there to go start placing central lines willy-nilly. You should discuss with your own hospital, your colleagues, if you're a trainee, certainly with your attending, and decide what's best for each individual patient and case.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I completely agree. And I agree too with your prompt for if you're really, really struggling for short-term venous access during a case, do not forget that a central line may, particularly a smaller bore central line and the right IJ, may be the safer option or more feasible option going forward in the OR.
And if you're going to the ICU, the chances are good that your ICU colleagues will thank you for it.
Yes.
Alyssa, awesome. Is there anything else you want to touch on before we move on?
Let me think. I think just again, emphasizing that it's important to be aware of the mechanical complications that can happen with central lines. It's important to know what complications are more common with each site. It's important to know what kind of things you can use to confirm that you're in the right place, both during and after the procedure. And it's important to think about how to maintain your skills and get feedback, but I don't think I have anything else to add.
Fabulous. Well, this is so useful and great, and I think people really get a lot out of it. Let's move to the portion of our show where we make random recommendations. Do you have something that you would recommend people check out for fun?
Yeah, so I have a couple of mine. So I tried to vary them up between, literature, vacations, and shoes. So for vacation recommendations, my family and I just came back from Banff and Jasper National Park in Canada. It was only about a 4-hour flight from Boston and then renting a car. It was incredibly beautiful no matter where we went. There were hikes for all different ages, fitness levels. Everything was just gorgeous no matter where you went. And it was incredibly bountiful for wildlife as well. We actually saw 3 bears while we were there. Nice.
How do you spell it?
Banff, B-A-N-F-F, and then Jasper, G-A-S-P-E-R.
Nice.
I'm hopeless at skiing. I hear it's great for that in the winter, but otherwise summer and the shoulder seasons are ideal. Second random recommendation I have is for the His Dark Materials series. It's a fantasy trilogy that I first read when I was actually only 10 years old. But I intermittently reread it. I think it's gone really well over the years. And the author, Philip Pullman, actually wrote it for no one particular in mind. It's still just as incredibly engaging, as beautiful as when I first read it. And I really think that each book in the trilogy is better than the last, with a lot of themes of parallel universes, the nature of humanity, morally complex characters. It's just a really fascinating series.
Totally agree. It's one of my favorites as well.
And then finally, the shoe recommendations. So during residency, I took up long distance running as a way to blow off steam and get my exercise in. The shoes that I've been using for the past few years are the Saucony Endorphin Speeds. And the 3s are currently on sale, which is part of the reason why I wanted to add the recommendation. But they have a nice bouncy feel. They're really good for everyday runs, but have also worked really well for me for training and long runs. And I think whether you're an experienced runner or someone who's just hoping to get into the sport, I think they're really, really nice.
Awesome. And I should say we are not sponsored by Saucony and are not getting any money for this recommendation. But if you're a Saucony rep out there and you want to sponsor the show, feel free to reach out. But that sounds great. Always good to have good shoe recommendations. I want to recommend a couple things. First, for those who are interested, ACRAC in Spanish is off to a great start. There are now 4 or 5 episodes in counting, and the goal is to get all of the ACRAC episodes translated into Spanish. The team is doing a fabulous job with that. And so if you're interested in hearing ACRAC in Spanish, or if you know people who are, send the link to them. It's also now on Instagram and Spotify, so you can grab the episodes there. And then also, I just finished a fantasy trilogy called the Lycanius Trilogy. That's L-I-C-A-N-I-U-S. by James, I believe it's pronounced Islington, Islington. Looks like Islington, but I think it's pronounced Islington. And it was great. I thought it was really well developed. It's not, you know, I think Lord of the Rings or Brandon Sanderson, which I think of are kind of like the highest possible quality, Game of Thrones up to the point where it didn't get completed. But this is good. If you're looking for a good fantasy trilogy, the Lycanius trilogy by James Islington is pretty good. So check it out. Awesome. All right. Well, Alyssa, this has been wonderful. Thank you so much for coming on the show.
Awesome. Thanks so much for having me, Jed. And I'm definitely going to check out that trilogy too.
Nice.
All right. Hopefully you got as much out of that as I did. That was really fantastic. Let us know what you thought. Go to the website, acrack.com, where you can leave a comment. Others can learn from what you have to say. If you are a fan of the show, you can follow us. We're on Twitter. We are on Facebook. We are on Reddit. And we are on Instagram. I'm at Jay Wolpaw on Twitter, and we're at Acrack Podcast. And you can find us on all those other platforms as well. If you are a fan of the show, please consider going to Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts and leaving a comment and a rating. It really helps others find the show. If you'd like to support the making of the show, please consider going to patreon.com/acrack. That's patreon.com/accrack, where you can become a patron of the show. Even if it's just a dollar or two that you pledge, it makes a big difference and we really appreciate it. You can also make donations anytime by going to paypal.me/acrack. Or looking up Jay Wolpaw on Venmo. Thank you so much to those who have already made donations and become patrons. We really appreciate it. Thanks, as always, to our fantastic ACRAC crew. Sonia Amanat is our tech lead, and Sophia Wu is our social media manager. William Mao is our production assistant. Thank you so much for the great work that you do. Our original ACRAC music is by Dr. Dennis Kuo. You can check out his website at studymusicproject.com. All right. That is it for today. For the ACRAC podcast, I'm Jed Wolpaw. Thanks for listening. Remember, what you're doing out there every day is really important and valued.
Are you looking for legit ways to make extra money? Our friends at The Side Hustle Show have put together this cool free 60-second quiz to help you do just that. All you got to do is go to hustle.show. You can do it right from your phone. Answer a few short multiple choice questions, and it'll recommend a few episodes of the hit Side Hustle Show podcast to start with. You can add your personalized Side Hustle Show playlist to your device, learn what works, and start making more money today. Again, that's at hustle.show, or follow the award-winning Side Hustle Show in your favorite podcast app.
In Indiana, summer means more than sunshine. It's hiking miles and miles of trails to magnificent views and cruising through caves on underground river rides. It's spending the night in a floating cabin and scuba diving into your next big adventure. It's riding a horse and buggy through historic towns and camping with elephants at a wildlife park. It's anything but ordinary. Plan your trip at inindiana.com/summer.